Before we go into the new album, I would like to go into your early years, really early years, when you started playing the guitar. Just a few questions. Was there any specific reason you picked up a guitar aged 13?
I remember when I was in kindergarten, I must have been 5 years old. There was this boy, and I think he was probably a couple of years older. He went to my school and he was playing the guitar. So I walked into like the auditorium and I saw him playing the guitar. And we were little kids, you know? And that's when I remember the first time falling in love with the guitar. I mean, the guitar just, it was really this. You know, you have these moments in life of clarity where you seem to like focus in on something and everything else goes away, but you're aware of everything. Like I could tell you the exact moment I saw that guitar. I could tell you what things smelt like. I could tell you what the surrounding area looked like. I could tell you the color of this chairs. I could tell you what this kid was wearing because it was a shocking moment, you know? And that's when I fell in love with the guitar. And I had a fantasy love affair with it until I finally got one when I was 12.
And who gave you your first
A
guitar?
friend of mine that that lived in my town had a guitar on his wall in his bedroom. And I would go over his house just to look at the guitar. And then one day I asked him, I said, "What do you know, how come you never play it?" I mean, the only reason I even hung out with this kid was because he had a guitar hanging on his wall. And it was a cool-looking guitar. It was a Tesco Del Rey, and it was red, and it had a whammy bar, and it had three pickups and, you know, like 20 switches, and it was like the most beautiful piece of art I have ever seen. And he said, "I don't want to play it. I'll sell it to you for $5." And I was like, "Oh." It was another moment of clarity. And I gave him the $5 and I got that guitar and I literally slept with it. It stayed in the in my bed with me, and my it went came to the bathroom with me, you know, when I ever had an opportunity to eat, I had it, you know. I mean, if I had an opportunity to have it, even when I was eating, I would have it.
Why?
Why?
Yeah, why? What
Because
makes
it felt like home. It felt like Christmas morning. Every time I picked it up, I saw Schwarzer Pizza all over the place. It was just this excitement.
How come it took you kindergarten? I think you were five,
Because it was
7 years.
off my radar that I could even own one. It
Yes.
seemed completely extraordinary. And I was afraid of it, but you know, because the guitar, I was intimidated because it was so beautiful. It was almost like if you're a gawky kind of a kid in high school and there's this beautiful girl that you fall in love with, you don't even have the courage to talk to her. More or less, the idea of kissing her or making out with her or, you know, having sex even when you know, if your mind goes there. But so it was off limits in a way. It was too good for me.
Did you talk to your parents about it?
No. I just bought the guitar. And they were like, "Okay, he's got a guitar."
No, but I mean, when you saw it at kindergarten and then.
No. But what I would do is, you know what Sears Roebuck is? It's a big department store in America. It's this department store. And they used to send out these catalogs so you can see all the stuff they have. And there was always a big catalog like this, but there was always one or two pages dedicated to cheap musical instruments. And they always had pictures of electric guitars. So I would wait for my mother's Sears catalog to come to the house, where I would feverishly thumb through it and fetish the pages that had pictures of guitars. It was like porn or something, you know? And it was just such an excitement even to see a picture of a guitar. And you know, oddly enough, I still get a thrill even when I see a guitar now.
Have you thought about it? What makes this instrument, this piece of strings for you such?
Well, first and foremost, before I even was really to understand the beauty and the pleasure of playing it, just the way it looked, it was very interesting, you know? I mean, it had a shape that was kind of, you know, in a way, sexy, and you know, and it had a long neck and strings, and when you play a guitar, it doesn't sound like any other instrument. It goes clang, you know, and strings vibrate together, you know, and you can add distortion. And I knew all this. I instinctively understood the guitar the moment I saw one. You know, I don't know why. You know, it just was one of those, I don't know, karma, whatever, you know. But I immediately felt the infinite depths of the expressional potential of a player and the dynamic nature of the guitar, that you can play it really, really, really soft and be really close to the note, you know, to hitting it as hard as you can and creating an explosion of sound. So all of this was just this amazing fascination.
Have you understood the guitar? Because you can now, you can play it really well, of course.
I understood it the moment I saw it, okay, when I was in kindergarten, but not understood it like I do, you know, like to how to play it. I understood the infrastructure of how to play it in my mind. Like, fingers go here, the pick goes there, you hit it hard, you hit it soft, you strum it, you play lead on it. But it was sort of like understanding how to cook, but never cooking.
Yeah.
You know, like understanding that, and some people don't. They understand other things.
Yeah.
You know, like, if I look at a piece of art, a beautiful piece of art, like I go to the Van Gogh Museum, I love Van Gogh, you know, he moves me. I can't for the life of me understand how anybody can do that. I don't see it in my head at all. I'm completely ignorant to the process of creating art. I mean, sure, I understand, you know, he takes the paintbrush and they do this and they do this, but I can't visualize that stuff in my head and then make it real. You know what I mean? Yeah. I have different brain muscles. Musicians think in musical terms.
No, but sometimes people say when you get a chance to really, get the knowledge of something, cooking or physics or playing the guitar, once you're really going into it, you only understand that there's so much more to learn that you actually know that you will never learn everything. Do you agree?
Or? Yeah, I agree. I agree. You can never learn everything because the ability to evolve anything is there. You know, the people who build all these buildings, they design these buildings because it's a natural instinct in them. They have we all have like different gifts and the ability to see things clear and other things not as clear. You know, for me, the moment I walked up to a piano when I was 5 years old and noticed that the notes went higher this way and lower that way, music became very clear to me. There was nothing I couldn't hear that I didn't know that this note's higher, this is a chord of, you know what I mean? And I thought that was just everybody heard music that way. I didn't realize till later it's musicians who hear music that way. And people who know how to, economic geniuses see economics that way. It's a natural. I have a friend that can speak fluently five languages with no accent in any language. Where does that come from? You know, was it something, you know, that was just, some people have a natural inclination to certain things so they can grasp them easier.
Yeah.
I used to teach guitar and I'd have students that would come to me and they'd have a deep passion and love for the guitar, but they were totally tone deaf. You know, a guitar solo just sounded like a series of Morse code, you know, and they had no idea of the, you know, of even the slightest, well, I shouldn't say the slightest, but, you know, the depths of music, you know, of the infrastructure of music. They loved listening to it and they liked the idea of playing. So those people, their passion drives them to slowly learn and evolve their craft. Meanwhile, that person, and I'm picking one in general, he owned a travel business. And he knew, destination places around the world, every exotic destination in the world, you know. And that's what he really liked. It was a natural gift for him, was that. So that's was we all kind of try to find things to evolve our talent. And then I've had students that started way down, you know, way deep in it, where you just they just got it, like Dweezil. Frank asked me to teach Dweezil some guitar when Dweezil first started. And at first, when Dweezil started playing, he couldn't even play like one string without hitting three strings. And I'm like, oh my God, you know. In 1 week, he was playing. How do you explain that? And in 3 weeks, he sounded like Edward Van Halen. I mean, you know, mockingly, but, and I'm like, where did that come from? How can somebody have such a natural talent, you know?
And what was it like for you when you picked up the guitar?
Very difficult. I'm very natural musically, but not on an instrument. I had to work really, really hard. And here's just a little insight into the way I perceive things, my brain muscles. I see music, you know what I mean? I hear music in my head, and we all do, composers do. I mean, that's how you create music. But I instinctively, immediately, intuitively understand how to get it out into the world, how to make it real. It's just a process for me. There's no experimenting. I get it immediately and I know how to do it. When it comes to playing an instrument, I have very, very little natural talent. I had to work really, really hard on the guitar, and I didn't sound good for years.
But what is really hard in hours a day? You had to practice really hard?
I practiced 15 hours a day sometimes. If I didn't practice 9 hours, I was depressed, you know, every day, you know, and that was the starting point, and then anything after that was good. Because I wasn't natural, but I loved it. And the biggest thrill for me, and today it's still the biggest thrill, is not being able to play something. And then working on it, and then all of a sudden being able to play it. That's my juice. And as far as writing music, you'd be surprised to know that I don't play any other instrument. I can't play the piano. I cannot go up to a piano and play a song. But I can compose something for the most accomplished pianist in the world that sounds like a breathtaking virtuosic piece, because I see it in my head. And that's not an uncommon thing for a composer, to not know how to play instruments, but to understand how they work and how to write something for somebody who does know how to play it.
But can you say that you really have a talent then for composing instead of playing the guitar? Playing the guitar, you had to work really hard?
Yeah.
Did you have to work composing?
No. No. From the moment I understood, from the moment it was, you know, I realized that I understood music, there's never been any kind of governor. You know, there was never a challenge in the idea. There is things that I wish that I can do better as a composer. Like, I know guys that they hear, they have perfect pitch, say. I don't have perfect pitch. I have very good relative pitch. But there's some conductors who can look at a transposed score and know what it sounds like. You know, if I look at a score, I have to, you know, look at it pretty carefully and imagine, you know, what it's going to sound like. You know, if I'm looking at just a piece of music, I can read it in my head and kind of understand what it sounds like. But there's guys that can read whole scores without hearing it. I can't do that. I wish I could do that. That'd be fun. And I probably could if I worked on it, but it's one of those things I haven't worked on. But what I feel like I'm strong at is the ability to have a musical idea and then know how to create a document or a recording that can express that idea.
You said that you had to teach Dweezil some guitar.
Yeah.
Is it true that Joe Satriani taught you the guitar?
Yeah, absolutely. Joe was maybe 4 years older than me, and we grew up in the same town. We went to the same school.
But how come the both of you made it really big? How come?
You'll have to ask God. I have no idea myself. It's phenomenal. I mean, we look at each other. We go, "Is this really happening?" Yeah, Really happened.
And what was he thinking about your, well, guitar playing the first few weeks when he had to teach you?
Well, he might have thought I was a musical idiot because I didn't even know how to put the strings on the guitar.
Okay.
I didn't know anything. I mean, I was able to, you know, I was chopping away at stuff.
Yeah.
But I didn't really understand how to tune it. I didn't, you know what I mean? It's just whatever the tuning turned into, that's what I just played. And I just played melodies and stuff. I had no really good technique or anything. And Joe was always great. I don't ever remember him not being great. And I was, I think, 12 or 13 when I started lessons. And I was very shy about playing the guitar. And I actually started with a friend of mine. We had to take lessons together for a little while because I couldn't even afford, you know, the $5 or whatever it was. But Joe was remarkable because every time he touched the instrument, it sounded like music came out of it. Even when he was showing me a scale or an exercise. And, you know, in our town, he was very well known as a great guitar player. I mean, even when you're 15 and you can play,
yeah. There's
not a lot, you know, 15-year-olds that could play. And he was much better than, much more accomplished at that time than anybody else that we knew. I would just marvel at how great he was. I'd scratch my head and I'd think, I really love Jimmy Page and Jeff Beck and Jimi Hendrix, but they're not as good as Joe. And you know, my 13-year-old mind, why isn't he as famous as these guys? Well, you know, now I, you know, surprise, surprise.
you send a music transcription of the Black Page to Frank Zappa. Do you still have the original transcript that you made?
Oh, yeah, it's around someplace.
Yeah?
Yeah, and I have the letter that he wrote me back after I sent it to him, and he actually sent me the music. And it was phenomenal.
How important was this for you? Doing this transcript and getting a reaction from him and then...
Well, it was surreal in a way, you know, because I adored Frank and his music. And I loved the idea of transcribing. And I was going to Berkeley, and that was a great way to develop your ears. And I was really into complex music. You know, and I was, you know, music to me on paper looked like art, you know, and I loved looking at notes. And Frank's music was very dense, so it was more beautiful to even just look at. And the Black Page was a very special piece because it had rhythmic, and you know, I'm very happy to go on record saying this because I believe it's true as far as I know. It had rhythmic complexities that virtually dwarf anything I've ever seen in any scores by any composer, including Stravinsky, Cage, Barres, Ligeti, you know, anybody that I've ever seen. Just the rhythmic complexity. But that doesn't make a good piece of music. What makes a great piece of music is how it affects the listener, you know, and the Black Page is a... Besides its musical density, its rhythmic density and the melody, it's a beautiful piece of music. The melody is beautiful. And there's nothing else that sounds like it in the whole world. Yeah.
So you still have it?
Oh, yeah.
And is it somewhere in the, I don't know, in your closet?
Oh, it's in my house, yeah. I have all my music in one location.
Okay. Well, you've worked with Frank Zappa, you've worked with David Lee Roth, Whitesnake, Joe Jackson, so many, many people. Are there, maybe you can pick one or two things that you've learned by while playing with someone, even a singer maybe, I don't know, that you say, well, that's also some sort of clarity moment for me, just like seeing...
Sure, yeah. Well, with Frank, there was a lot of clarity moments. A lot of it was in the studio, understanding production, understanding how to record properly, understanding how to protect yourself in being an independent musician and facing the music industry. How to be honest and straight with people, but don't be taken advantage of. And many things, you know. With Dave Roth, it was really great educational experience because I learned how to, you know, be a rock star. But I learned how to conduct myself.
Why are you doing this?
Well, because there's a lot of concepts of what a rock star is, and there might be some people that say, oh, he thinks he's a rock star. But the fact is I was hanging around with the biggest rock star in the world at the time, you know? And, you know, for greater or lesser, I was considered a rock star, and some people still do, but that doesn't really mean anything to me much. Yeah. I mean, it's fun, you know, I'll wear that badge, I don't care. But I learned how to conduct myself in the press, you know, because you learn that when you say things, they have an impact, and that how the press takes what you say and they filter it through their own mind and then edit it and put it out there, and you better be pretty unequivocal when you say things, and how when you do say things they affect other people, and you know, how to conduct yourself on stage in front of a large group of people, how to emote, how to take control, how to be commanding, you know, because that's what rock star stuff is, and that Dave was an expert at it. Yeah. You know, and then with bands like you know, like Alcatraz, it was a great experience. You know, I learned band camaraderie, you know, and touring and being in, you know, being with a band. With Frank, it was different. You were musicians and it was individual, but the guys in Alcatraz, they were wonderful guys, and we got along, and it was nice, you know, nice kind of a family unit. I enjoyed that very much. And then with Whitesnake, I learned a lot about how to be political, in a sense. You know, there's some certain political dynamics. Because with Dave Roth was very harsh. You know, he was very solid and strong with some of the ways that he conducted himself. And I became I was a very intense young man, really intense, with myself and with my demands on myself. And when I brought that, and Dave was too, but when I joined Whitesnake, I tried to impose that on everybody else, in a sense. And you know, it was a whole different environment. And, you know, I had the tendency to be a bit prickish, you know? And I all of a sudden had a hit solo record and everything. So there was an ego balancing that I needed to understand. Because Dave didn't allow you for your ego to, you know, explode.
Yeah.
He kept it very controlled. David Coverdale, on the other hand, you just do, you know, you whoever you are, you do whatever you want. So that was a good experience. You know, I had to learn how to control tour politics and band dynamics. It's hard to explain, you know, but it was a really good learning experience. Every experience is a learning experience. It's your perspective.
Yeah.
It all comes down to your own personal perspective. What you get, your view on the music industry, your view on your own career, your view on the people you're in a band with, is molded by your own attitude when you're in those situations. And your attitude is based on your perspective. And if you can take control of the way you want to think about things, you can change your perspective, and the entire experience of everything you're doing will change. It's as simple as if you change the way you're looking at something, whatever you're looking at will change.
It's once you know how to look?
Yes. Once you realize that you have control over choosing how you want to look at something.
When did you know this?
It's only a concept that I was really, I mean, I've heard it my whole life, but I never really understood it. I would say probably 3 or 4 years ago, I started to really understand the power of personal choice. Because we think that we're trapped. We think, because of past experiences, see, we create our own identity. And our identity is forged by the way we view our past experiences. And we're all prisoners of that shit. You know, you're 5 years old and somebody says, what's wrong with you? What, are you stupid? You'll question yourself for the rest of your life if you're, you know, if you don't find independence.
But how come you got, was there a certain thing that happened 3 or 4 years ago that made you this, well, that gave you this realization?
It's something that happened when I was 20, 22. I was going through a very dark period. I don't know why. It was a deep, deep depression. And I reached a point where I realized I didn't want that in my life. I wanted truth. and I begged and prayed as hard as I could with all of my heart to understand truth, to find the right, the real truth, not opinions, not ideologies, not, you know, and that's what I wanted more than anything, more than being a great guitar player, more than being a great musician. All that stuff's peripheral to life, to real life. So there was a slow process, because whatever you want, you get. And whatever you really want, you get. And whatever you really, really, really don't want, you get. Because whatever your mind is focusing on, you pull these things into your life. So your perspective is so important. And for me, it was a slow build, but it got me out of that depression and really lifted me up. And I mean, and I don't lose, and sometimes you go like this, you know, it's not just a straight, you know. But I've always kept that desire. You know what I mean? And it's a sincere desire. And when you ask for something like that, you start seeing things about yourself. Because really, the way the world is relative, it's the way you see yourself that shapes the world, you know? It doesn't shape the world, it shapes your perspective on the world. So if you want to continually change, you have to have that desire, you know? So, you know, I can pinpoint certain points in my life where, you know, you have these moments of clarity. You know, like I was talking about the academic portion, the clarity of the guitar, but there's really we all have these very subtle, intuitive moments of clarity, but you have to want them. If you're stuck in a particular way of thinking for your whole life, you're not going to get them.
You have to see them.
You have to want to be, you have to want to improve yourself as a person.
I have to stop within a few minutes, but the story.
I just want to clarify.
Yeah.
So about 4 years ago, one of the realizations that actually came, because we hear things, and we say, "Oh yeah, yeah, yeah," everything that comes to us is our own doing. But you don't really understand it until you see it intuitively. So for me, probably about 5 years ago, 4 years ago, it started to really dawn on me that I have control over the way I think. Nobody else, you know. And that you have to take that control and pull it away from things that are detrimental to you and try to push it to... I'm not there yet. I'm talking like this guy that's, you know, a philosopher. I'm a work in progress like anybody else, and I've got issues. And the more you want to see your own issues, trust me, they'll be presented to you. Anyway, okay.
The story of light. What is it?
It's just an expression of all the stuff I was just talking about.
Yeah. So it's a natural... This album, it's been 7 years since your previous album. What made you... is there a certain time frame that you wrote these songs, or is it certain...
Well, you know, I come up with ideas now and then, you know, little pieces of inspiration that come in various ways, and I try to capture them. These days, like, you know, the past years I've been using my iPhone, you know, and I'll just get a riff and I'll say, okay, you know, and then I put them on the shelf, and then when I go to make a record, I'll find some of these riffs and I'll let them, you know, I'll hear, you know, I'll be able to identify if I think they have potential. And then sometimes, you know, I come up with a title and it helps me, you know, and then I'll think about an album as a whole, you know, and then it'll start to come out. The story of light is part of this huge trilogy of a story that I'm writing, the first record being Real Illusions. But without getting into any great depth of the concept, which you can get little inklings of by reading the liner notes and stuff, the story of light in general, the music, is I'm really happy with it. I love the way it turned out, and I think it's very much like my other records in the sense that there's a lot of diversity, but it's not genre-specific. And it has a bit of an evolution to it because we evolve, and you know, as people, and as when we evolve, our creative overviews change. So I think the record has a different depth than my other records.
This is your second album in the trilogy. Can you say, well, what the first, just briefly, the first and this one, what it's for you?
Well, I came up with this. I've been building this story for some time. and I wanted to express it musically over a long period of time. Instead of like, you know, here's a record that's a concept record, and here's the second part, and here's the third part. All the music in the Real Illusions trilogy is broken up and it's dished out in different order. It's not like, here's this record, this record, this record. You can get inklings of the story by following it, but my goal is at the end of when the three records are released, then to release a four CD box set that has all the music in the right order, additional music, some of the songs that had melodies would have lyrics. There'd be narrations, you know, narratives, and it'd be a very accessible, easy to follow, almost like a rock opera of sorts from beginning to end.
Last question: there's a song on the album. It's called "No More Amsterdam."
Yeah, you deserve an explanation for that one.
Yeah,
it's not what I think. You know, it's funny. I knew I had this beautiful piece of music, and I wanted to put these vocals on it. And the vocals were very personal to the story. It's a story about this guy who actually has a conversation with his guardian angel or his better judgment, you know, whatever. So I needed somebody to, a co-singer. I wanted a female co-singer. And I started to write the lyrics, and the song was originally going to be called "The More That I See, The Less I Know," because that's the only line I had. And I could not come up with the rest of the lyrics. And I had known Amy Mann from college. We went to college together. And my wife, who was best friends with Amy at the time, Pia, she was my girlfriend in college, was really good friends with Amy. So through the years, I had Amy's music. And when I was having trouble writing the song, Pia said, "Why don't you call Amy?" So I did, and she liked the song, and she wanted to work with me. And I just said, you know, she's like a poet. So I said, "Can you write the lyrics? This is what I'm thinking." And she came back and she gave me these lyrics, and they were just beautiful. But there was this line that said, "No more Amsterdam." And the first thing I'm thinking is, oh no, I can't use that line because people in Holland will think that, you know, it's about, you know, drugs and all this, what you're probably thinking. But then, you know, reading into it, it's not what it's about, you know, necessarily. You know, it's about somebody that's actually really attached to their home, and they have to leave and leave things behind in order to grow. And it's a beautiful song, you know. But I was still concerned because Amy thought that the best title would be "No More Amsterdam." I'm like, oh, damn. So I call my friend Co, and I send them the lyrics, and I say, "Listen, this is the situation, and I'm not sure what to name the song." And he said, "Don't be silly. The people in Holland are much more sophisticated than that. You know, they're not going to think that if you call the song 'No More Amsterdam,' it's, you know, my fans will listen to the music. They'll hear that, you know, I wouldn't write a song like, you know, 'This place is filled with drugs and dope and porn and no more for me,' you know. That's stupid. That's not what it's about. I mean, it could be if you hear it that way, and maybe elements of it are, but I do believe that the Dutch are more sophisticated than that.
I think they are.
Yeah, I do.
Thank you.
Thank you.